What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of Eyewitness History. This episode, I have the great pleasure of speaking with Hank Rogers. Hank Rogers is the president of the Tetris Company and a pioneer in the video game industry. In the 1980s, Rogers brought role-playing games to Japan and turned a little-known game called Tetris into an international phenomenon after intense negotiations with the Soviet Union and Nintendo. His efforts helped establish the Game Boy as a market leader and made Tetris one of the most popular games of all time. Rogers' story became folklore in the gaming industry and is the subject of the 2023 Apple TV Plus film, Tetris. Today, Rogers is the founder of 10 companies and nonprofit organizations focused on renewable energy, space exploration, and ending the use of fossil fuels on Earth. A near-fatal heart attack in 2005 made Rogers identify his true missions in life and led to him founding the Blue Planet Foundation, a nonprofit organization that has been instrumental in implementing renewable energy policies in Hawaii. Realizing this model needed to be exported to the rest of the world, Rogers in 2021 founded the Blue Planet Alliance, an organization helping island communities disproportionately affected by climate change transition from being reliant on importing fossil fuels to using 100% renewable energy. He's had great success in this, as we get into in the interview. It was such a pleasure having him on, and now I give you Hank Rogers. Okay, I'm here with Hank Rogers. Hank, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
Oh, you're so welcome.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. I'm really excited to speak with you. I want to discuss you, Tetris, your brushes with history, and what you're doing now. Before we track through all that, Hank, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you've done and do.
Oh, my goodness. My name is Hank Rogers. I'm a recovering game designer. I wrote the first role-playing game in Japan, became a publisher of computer games, traveled around the world looking for games, found a little game called Tetris. How can I say? Ran the Tetris company. I still do, kind of. And started a mobile phone game company in 2002, sold it in 2005, made a bunch of money so I didn't have to work anymore, had a heart attack, found my missions in life, and now I'm mostly on my mission, starting with ending the use of carbon-based fuel.
Excellent. Thank you, Hank. Yes, I heard about your Widowmaker episode. I'm glad to hear that you're doing well. Winding the clock back then, Hank, I'd love to know, what was Black Onyx?
Oh, my goodness. Black Onyx. I was just showing somebody that my Black Onyx t-shirt yesterday. This is Black Onyx.
Oh, wow.
So I created the first role-playing game in Japan in 1984 or 1983. Prior to, you know, I majored in computer science at the University of Hawaii, and I minored in Dungeons and Dragons. Everybody that, like, used to watch me thought I was wasting so much time because I was cutting classes so I could play D&D. Guess what? 6 years later, personal computers came out in Japan, and I thought, hey, I can do this. And, you know, I went from having done a bunch of homework assignments to writing a full computer game, which I had no idea what I was doing, but I did. And it turned into the number one game in Japan in 1984, started my career as a publisher and a game designer.
Wonderful. Thanks, Hank. I think that's a good springboard. Yeah, I won't torture our audience any further. Yes, on to Tetris, of course. So I'd love to kind of put our audience there with you. I'd love for you to please walk our listeners through what it was like the first time you saw Tetris at CES in Las Vegas.
Yeah, so my job at that time, I was running a company, a publishing company. What I was doing in Vegas was looking for games to bring to Japan. Because instead of me writing the game, and I wrote the first two games for the company, I decided that, you know, I would let other people write the games in other places in the world, and I would bring them to Japan and have Japanese programmers turn them into Japanese products. And so here I am. I'm at the Spectrum Holobyte booth, and there is Tetris. And, you know, normally when I'm looking for a game, I spend a couple of minutes, you know, you stand in line until it's your turn, spend a couple of minutes playing the game, and then you go on to the next line and wait in line and play that game for a couple of minutes. By the time I was standing on the Tetris line for the fourth time, I realized I was hooked on this damn game. And so, you know, I just couldn't stop playing it. And so I at least had one customer, and that's me. The game is, at that time, even at that time, was, how can I say, surprisingly simple. It's like, how can a game this simple be this interesting? But that didn't scare me, because I play Go, which is a Japanese board game, which looks real simple, black and white stones on a grid. And there's no graphics to Go at all. In chess, at least you have little characters like the king and the queen and the knight and, you know, all of these characters. But in Go, it's just black and white stones. And yet, this game is way deeper than chess. And so I gave Tetris a chance. I thought, well, this game could be way more interesting than any of these other games that have all these fancy-ass graphics. And I guess I was right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, thank you, Hank. You may have already answered it, but I'll take the risk regardless. Try my best to capture kind of what that eureka moment was like for you at CES, you know. So if possible, I'd love to know what you saw in it that led you to get a license to publish it in Japan.
I mean, I couldn't stop playing it. And that is the first sign of a game that you want to publish. So, yeah. You know, I said, okay, I'm going to take this game back to Japan and I'm going to see how many other people in the company get hooked on it. And everybody does. Are you kidding me? I haven't met anybody that I've turned Tetris onto who didn't get completely hooked on it. So that was just confirmation. But I already knew the game was like something when I was standing in front of that machine. I need this game for Japan.
Extraordinary. Hank, when was the first time you went behind the Iron Curtain to the Soviet Union?
That was in February 1989, late February. It was dead winter. And I thought I was going to be able to buy a warm coat in Moscow. You know, like I always wanted to kind of have a fur coat. And I thought, wow, I'm going to the home of fur coats. And the answer is no, nobody buys a fur coat in the middle of the winter. They already have them by then. So I couldn't buy anything. I froze my sauce.
That's funny. Yeah. You told Leslie Wilcox a few years back, to quote you, it's all power trips in terms of dealing in business over there, and you didn't work that way. You told her that you didn't need power, you just had to have honesty. Could you talk a little bit more about dealing with Soviets from a business standpoint?
Yeah, the Soviets lived in a society where everything was power. There was no, how can I say, there was no niceties, and everybody pushed everybody around. In fact, when I was sitting in the room and being interrogated the very first day, they were arguing with each other. So I could see the power trips going on between them. And then they would turn their power trip on me, and I'm just telling them how the business works. And they never met anybody who's like just simple and honest about what he's doing. So they're kind of like suspicious. And a couple of times they would say something to me in Russian, thinking that I actually spoke Russian because I knew what they were talking about. And so I already said, stop your arguing, gentlemen. The answer is yes. You know, that was, you know, it was one of my lines. And that made them think that I spoke Russian, which I didn't.
Interesting.
So they were a power trip. It was all top down. You know, you're always fearful of what somebody else is going to do to you if you didn't do whatever it is that they needed you to do, whatever. So it was that whole hierarchy, which is kind of, I don't know, creepy.
Right. I understand that. I'm curious to know a little bit more, perhaps, about what that personality clash might be between yourself and them, because I haven't known you very long. I've known you all of, you know, 5 minutes here, but you strike me as someone who's fairly chill and a nice guy. I've seen you here and in other interviews. I'm just curious about what that personality collision might look like.
Yeah, so the personality collision, basically, in so many words, is that my usual charm that I use on people to get them to like me and then want to do stuff with me wasn't going to work there, because I think they would interpret that as being, I don't know, acting, because people aren't that nice, you know? People expect them. And so it was funny because, like, in day two, they wanted me to make them a proposal and, you know, proposal. So I decided that I was going to fight fire with fire, and I made a proposal. And then, you know, it had all these big legal words that I could dream up, you know, and, you know, like, this offer expires in 1 week, after which everything here is null and void. And I use all these, you know, boom, like, you know, I gave it. And obviously, that's what they needed. They needed to, you know, this is it. And they asked me, Mr. Rogers, when are you coming back to Moscow? I said, what do you mean? He says, well, we need time to think this over. I said, it's not how business works. I leave here with or without the rights, I'm not coming back. So business works faster than that. You know, there's a bunch of things that I taught them. I taught them that I needed to have tea or coffee during the meeting and stuff like that. They just don't have any of those niceties. I'm living in Japan, for Christ's sake. You go to a meeting, they give you tea and cookies and stuff, and there was nothing like that. But they have samovar, which is like, they actually have a tradition of tea. They just forgot about it, you know?
That's very interesting. You've spoken in the past, quite warmly, I have to say, about your friendship with Alexei Pajitnov, of course, the inventor of Tetris, creator of it. When did you first meet him, and what would you say bonded you to?
So I first met him the second day that I went to Ilorg. Have you seen the movie?
Yes, I have. I saw it yesterday, as a matter of fact.
On the second day that I went to Ilorg, and the first day I walked in and I showed Belikov the game, and he told me that they never licensed this to anybody. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm in such deep kimchi, I can't believe it. And I said, I want to meet someone tomorrow, because I didn't know who he was, or, you know, I wanted the right people in the room. So he invited me to come back the next day, which, by the way, meant that I was invited. I wasn't just trespassing. The first day I was so totally trespassing. The second day I was invited. And sure enough, he got the troops together. That included Alexei Pajitnov. And why was he there? He's the only one in the entire room who understands anything at all about a game. Everybody else is just bureaucrats that are trying to figure out, you know, whatever. I don't know what they're trying to figure out, because they can't even figure out intellectual property.
Right.
But anyway, so Alexei, when I started talking and they all started asking me questions, Alexei all of a sudden realized that he finally met his first fellow game designer. And wow, then we had game design to talk about. So, you know, at the end of the meeting, he invited me to meet him that evening. And we talked about game design and stuff. Yeah, I mean, we bonded. He couldn't be more different than me. He's sort of introvert. He likes classical music. You know, if you left him alone, he'd be inventing mathematical puzzles or writing or something. I'm an extrovert. I like to be with people and so on. But we get along just fine. So we've traveled together. We did the Ural Pass, the two of us, like high school kids. And one day it's my turn and it's just an adventure. We don't know where we're going to stay or anything, where we're going to go. The other day, the next day, it's going to be his turn. And he plans everything. Where we're going to go, where we're going to stay, and da, da, da. So that was a very interesting trip, because it went back and forth and back and forth. And we went to Berlin, Prague, to Vienna, Salzburg, München, Amsterdam. It was fun.
That's awesome. Thanks, Hank. I'd love to talk, to wind it back a little bit, about that first day at Ilorg. So just to make sure I have this right, was the movie correct that it was unlawful for you to trespass that first day?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? I'm there on a tourist visa. I'm really not allowed to do anything except go to tourist destinations and take pictures. I'm not supposed to be talking to any Russian people, and they're not supposed to talk to me. So when Alexei and I met at his house, for example, I thought I was breaking the law, but he knew he was breaking the law. So, but it was right there, you know, perestroika and glasnost, things were changing. So people were taking more liberties, more chances. So I think I came there at the right time. But yeah, absolutely. I was on a tour. That's what my interpreter, they got it right. They say, you can't go in there. I said, what do you mean I can't go in there? So you're here on a tourist visa. You know, and I'm thinking, how do you know that? Well, I stayed in a hotel that was all full of tourists. So it wasn't very hard for her to figure that out. And then I said, I'm going in. I didn't come all this way to stand in front of a door and then go back to Japan and get a visa. Are you kidding me? And I said, I'm going in. Are you coming with me? He says, no, I can't go in there. I said, okay, I'm going in anyway. And I went in. And, you know, the thing that they didn't get, there's this whole protocol thing. There was a window with a guy with a hat who was the protocol guy who's supposed to give my credentials. I didn't have any credentials. So I just stood there and waited in the lobby till somebody came up to me and talked to me. And I figured somebody who could speak English would come and talk to me, which is what happened. Eventually, a woman came to and talked to me, and I explained, I'm from Japan. I'm the publisher of this game. I will need to talk to someone about the Game Boy rights, or the handheld rights to this game. And she went and came back with Belikov. And then went through the whole scene of him looking at my box. And he said, wow, we never published this. And we never granted anyone the console rights. I'm like, holy. Wow. That was a pretty crazy moment.
Yeah.
I think they captured it.
They did. That's extraordinary. That was one part of the movie that I thought, this must be Hollywood licensed. There's no way that happened.
It wasn't my property. It was my in-laws. It's even worse. You know, I had used all of my in-laws' land as collateral for this loan to make 200,000 cartridges, $2 million. If somebody had come along and swat and licensed Tetris, they could have told me, no, you can't release those cartridges. And they would have become garbage. And I would have lost my in-laws' entire thing that they worked for their entire lives.
Yeah. That's incredible. It's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
Who was Robert Stein?
Robert Stein was a Hungarian Jew. And I don't say that in a bad way because I used to be, my dad was in a gem business. So I have lots and lots of experience with his type of person. He survived the Holocaust. So obviously when he was a kid, so he's obviously got that. So I have great respect for Robert Stein, where he came from and what he was doing. He was for our industry, an older guy. And he was trying to sell Hungarian games into the U.S. and whatever. So he had a little group of people. His company was called Andromeda. And he's the one who licensed Tetris to Mirrorsoft. And that's Kevin Maxwell in the first place. And I went up the food chain. I went Spectrum Holovite, Mirrorsoft. I went all the way to Robert Stein because I knew him, because I knew everybody. My job was to find games. And so I made a deal with him that he would represent me to get the handheld rights. And I paid him $25,000. So he was my agent. And then things got bent out of shape when I started bugging him as I need this, because at a certain point I'd made a deal with Arakawa. I shook his hand on, $1 million, for Christ's sakes. And I needed those rights. And so then I started bugging him. And he just kept putting it off. And it was just driving me nuts. And finally, he said, okay, I'm going to go to a trade show in Germany. And after the trade show, then I'm going to go to Moscow and I'll be there for a week. And then you show up. And it's like, why would that be? I just couldn't figure it out. You know, why is he putting me off? And at the same time, Arakawa calls me and they said that somebody offered him the Game Boy rights. So I'm going, holy, somebody's doing an end run on me here.
Yeah.
And so I thought Stein was double dealing. Probably wrong about that, but I had no way of knowing. So 2 days later, I got on a plane and went to Moscow. So I was there at the same time that Stein was there and Kevin Maxwell.
Right.
And I didn't know that. I kind of knew that Stein was going to be there, but I had no idea that Kevin Maxwell was there.
That's incredible. So then, Tetris obviously gets out, it explodes globally. It became a launch title for Nintendo's Game Boy. I'd love to know, what was your role in securing Tetris as a launch title? And then how did you envision the partnership between Tetris and the handheld console?
Yeah, so, Tetris, I was already publishing Tetris in Japan on 8 different computer platforms and on Nintendo. I mean, the family computer, which is the NES over here. And Game Boy came out and I thought, oh, Tetris is the perfect game for Game Boy because Game Boy has a tiny screen, not so many dots. And so if you have a little like a shooting game, that the bullet is so tiny that people can't even see it. Well, older people for sure can't. So it needed a game that had simple shapes that were easy to see. And oh my gosh, Tetris is like perfect. So yeah, I did go to NOA, Nintendo of America, and I spoke with Mr. Arakawa. I asked him, Arakawa-san, I know you're about to release Game Boy and you always include a game with the first, when you release the machine, you always include a game. What game are you planning to include? He said, well, I'm planning to include Mario. And I said, what about Tetris? And he said, why should I include Tetris? And I said, well, if you want little boys to buy your Game Boy, then include Mario. But if you want everyone to buy your Game Boy, you should include Tetris. And then he called in his experts and they all agreed with him. So you can still sell Mario afterwards and make the money on Mario. So that was the beginning of that. And, I made him a deal and we shook hands. And that was January. February, I was on a plane to Moscow.
Wow. Looking back, I'm keeping an eye on our time here, Hank. I know there's a lot that we want to run through. Looking back, what do you consider to be the most significant impact that Tetris has had on the gaming industry?
I think that the most significant thing that Tetris brought to the industry is that women started playing games. Because before that, it was a male-dominated, guys making games for guys. And, 96 or 97% of the people playing games at that time were guys. And here is it, Tetris, and all of a sudden it's completely gender balanced. You know, just as many women play as men. And that was the first game that women didn't mind to play.
Hmm.
So I think that's the biggest impact.
Huh. When and why did you start the Tetris company?
So at the end of 95, part of the whole deal of getting the console rights, which is part of the movie, I got the console rights for Nintendo. I brought Arakawa and Howard Lincoln to Moscow. They had to have right of title going all the way back to the author, which is Alexei Pajitnov. And so the paperwork that was created at that time was Alexei gave his rights to the computer center where he worked for a period of 10 years, which started in 85 and ended in 95.
Mm.
So come 95, all rights to Tetris in the world come to a screeching halt because the computer center no longer has the rights. Ilorg no longer has the rights, and so on. So before that happened, Alexei said, Hank, I need you to help me. And I said, what's the problem? I said, well, come 95, Ilorg is going to say that I never had any rights. They're going to claim that it was either work for hire or made under a situation where people didn't have any copyrights to anything and that they have all these rights, which they didn't. Ilorg was only ever meant to be an agent for the computer center. But everybody became private companies. And so he said, they're going to claim. And Ilorg had all of the worldwide trademarks and copyrights in 60 countries. Nintendo did that for them. And so come the end of the year, I would have had to fight in 60 countries to claim the copyright and trademark, which I didn't have that kind of money. So we started negotiating with Ilorg. Ilorg was ready to give us 20%. We were ready to give them 20%. And it was like that. It was an impasse for most of the year. And then, you know, everything started to coming to an end. And so Ilorg was realizing that they didn't have any more, how can I say, no more revenue because the rights were going to end everywhere. And so I went to Moscow and made a deal with them. So, okay, let's go 50-50. Rather than fight, let's go 50-50. And so I created Blue Planet Software in Hawaii to be the partner. And Ilorg was the other partner, and we made the Tetris company, and I ran the Tetris company. So that's the beginning of the Tetris company.
Understood. Thank you, Hank. I do have one quick question I'd love to ask you just about the movie, which I watched it yesterday, the movie Tetris, of course. Loved it. You know, I've had the honor of interviewing a few people now that have had movies made about their lives, and it's always interesting. How surreal is it for you to see not quite your life, not quite a parody of your life, but sort of, what shall we call it, something like your life portrayed on film?
You know, I think it's a great honor to have a movie made about you while you're still alive. I mean, most other people, you know, we have to wait till they've gone before they make a movie. There's Elton John and me. I don't know who else has got him. I mean, of course, there are other people. It's a great honor to be recognized in that way. You know, people coming out of the woodworks, everybody that's ever been my friend is now my friend again. Wants to meet up and so on and so on, which is fine. It's fun. And, you know, I think this, well, first of all, yes, it's surreal. It's launched my career in a very strange and different way that I never would have thought would ever happen. And it's very useful because, you know, I have my missions in life that I'm working on. And this has given me a chance to expand that platform. People want to talk to me about what I'm doing now. I think that's a great thing. That really helps a lot.
Yeah, absolutely, Hank. Thank you. And you allow me a very smooth transition there. So I appreciate that. So yeah, beyond Tetris, I'd love to talk about projects and ventures that you're involved in currently. Could you give our listeners a sense of that?
Yeah. So I sold my mobile phone game company in 2005. And a month later, I had a heart attack. It was a 100% blockage of the Widowmaker, which is the largest artery in your heart. Obviously, I survived. I have two stents, no problem. But in that ambulance, it was dubious whether I was going to survive or not. The ambulance guys, the paramedic, didn't think I was going to make it. He told me that a couple of days later. So I really didn't think you were going to make it. So when the blank hit the fan in the ambulance, I knew it because he was in the cockpit talking. And I'm looking at the ceiling. And it's like a month after I sold my company. I said, you got to be kidding me. I haven't spent any of the money yet. You know, like, you're going to freak me out now? I work my off all my life. Finally, I get some money. You know, I can do whatever I want. And you take me out now. And then second, I said, no, I'm not going. I still have stuff to do. And, you know, those were prophetic words. And so in the recovery room, I started thinking about, what did I mean by that? I still have stuff to do. And I worked it back from the end of my life backwards. What is it that's really going to piss me off if I didn't do something about it at the end of my life? Because that's the regret. I think heaven is that you look back on your life and say, ah, this was great. And I had a great time. And hell is like, damn it, I should have done this and this and this and this, you know? I should have told my kids that I love them or whatever. I mean, there's all these regrets. And I think that's hell. It all happens in the last second of your life. So here I am, and I'm looking for my bucket list. And the first item on my bucket list came to me. It was in the back of the newspaper. It said, in Hawaii, by the way, said, oh, by the way, we're going to kill all the coral in the world by the end of the century. And that's just like, it hit me. It was like in the back of the newspaper. This should be front page news. But no, it's like, as a matter of fact, we're going to do this. And what's causing that is ocean acidification. What's causing that is carbon dioxide. What's causing that? We are. So I said, okay, that's it. My mission number one is to end the use of carbon-based fuel. And then I started thinking about how I'm going to do that. And I formed a foundation in Hawaii. It's not really a foundation because we don't give anybody any money. A nonprofit that's working to end the use of carbon-based fuel in Hawaii, because I believe that before I can ask other people to clean their room, I have to clean my room. And so we went to bat. It took us 7 years to get to the point where we got Hawaii to actually have a mandate of 100% renewable energy by 2045. The date is actually irrelevant. It's the fact that everybody says we're going to end this by 2045. That's the big deal. After the mandate, everybody started not thinking, not like putting it, how can I say, people say, there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm not even going to think about it. They go from not thinking about it at all to, how are we going to do this? And that, how are we going to do it? The important bit, the electric company who fought us tooth and nail on this legislation, finally, after 6 months, said, you know what? We figured it out. We can actually do this by 2040. And then we followed up by changing the business model of the utility. They used to make 10% on the price of oil. Now they make more on the price of renewable. And oil cost them 25 cents per kilowatt hour. Renewable, including storage, cost them 12. So even if they make more money, instead of 2.5 cents, say 3 cents, it's still cheaper for the ratepayers in Hawaii. They make more money. People pay less money. It's win-win. And they're moving fast. We have already hit our 2030 goal of 40% renewable energy in Hawaii today.
Wow.
And so, and then 20 other states have copied our legislation. So it's moving across the country. So this, the idea of jurisdictions deciding that we're going to go 100% and then figuring out how to do it is the thing that needs to happen. You know, everything else, you know, here's my problem. My problem is that the IPCC said that we need to stay under 2 degrees increase in temperature, or 1.5. What can I do about it? What can New York City or Honolulu do about it? What can Hawaii do about it? What can the United States do about it? It's really a fuzzy goal. It's not a clear thing that we can actually say, I want this done by such and such a date. No, it's not. It's a, there's a laundry list of things that you need to do to be able to achieve that target. But 100% renewable energy is a very clear target deadline. If you don't have a deadline, nothing happens. If I gave my kid a homework assignment and say, I don't care when you finish this, you know, just finish it someday. It's never going to get finished.
Right.
It's got to be here by Friday. If it's not by Friday, you fail. So if we're not done fixing climate change by 2045, we fail. That's the way it goes. And by having the deadline and then showing that we can totally beat the deadline by miles, which is what we're doing in Hawaii, we can export that to the rest of the world. So now I'm in New York. I have a new NGO called the Blue Planet Alliance, and we're doing the same thing we did in Hawaii for the rest of the world, starting with island countries.
Excellent. Thank you. And then just to make sure it didn't blow past your audience a little bit too quickly, what was the name of the foundation again?
In Hawaii, it's called the Blue Planet Foundation, and in New York, it's called the Blue Planet Alliance. Why is it the Alliance?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll give you an example. I was at OPEC. I was at COP. COP and OPEC, they sound the same. I was at COP 27 last November. And in Egypt, there were over 600 OPEC representatives there, oil producing, whatever. So that was kind of like they're running the agenda for stopping climate change. Are you serious? These guys should be barred from being there. And they were the biggest contingent. Why is that? It's because all of the other climate fighters, like me, all have their own little NGOs, and we all fight little fights, and OPEC guys can just flick us off the planet, whatever. We just don't have a voice. So we need to unite. We need to have an alliance. And all of us need to have one voice where we say no to something, whatever it is, or yes to something, whatever it is. But we need to have one voice. And it doesn't have to be my voice. It has to be the voice of all of the members of the alliance that together have one voice. Just like the G7 says, the war in Ukraine is wrong. That's a voice. And if the United States or if France or whatever, one of those countries says it, it's one thing. But if they all say it at the same time, it's a much louder voice. And we need to have louder voice. So we're signing MOUs, Memoranda of Understanding, with all of the other NGOs. And it basically says that we agree to work together to create a world in which humanity and nature live in harmony. It's something everybody can agree to.
Yeah.
Not contentious, and it's not my thing. My thing is carbon-based fuel, but maybe somebody else's mangroves, you know, or plastic in the ocean, or I really don't care what your thing is, but, you know, living in harmony with nature is everybody's thing. It should be the way we live.
The common cause of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you mentioned something that I think was really important, which is that psychological shift from, you know, the average person just thinking, well, there's just nothing I can do about it, so I'm not even going to think about it, to then asking themselves the question of, what can I do about it? For what, I hate to have to say this, but A, recognizing that there is a problem, yeah, which is its own conversation, and then understand that they have a roadmap to actually being part of a solution. It's difficult to get a large contingent, the world, to buy into that sometimes.
You know, it's funny. It happens quicker than you think. I think all of a sudden, you know, young people are going to say, you know, I'm not putting up with this. This is my future that you're messing up. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, I was 17 years old. And they were basically saying, you know, you're just a kid. You don't know what you're talking about. And I'm saying, wait a minute, you're sending me to Vietnam next year to die for your dumb idea, whatever it is. This is not my war. Those people have never attacked me. They've never threatened me. They're just people living on the other side of the world. And you care about how they think or that they don't have capitalism or whatever it is. That is not our business. And so we young people at that time, we went and demonstrated 1, 2, 3, 4. We don't want your effing war.
Mm-hmm.
And I need young people to rise up today and say, you know, we don't want climate change. We don't want your carbon-based economy. We don't want your gas guzzler cars, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We demand change. And they need to go and push their parents or their adults that are around them. You know, that's the only way we ever quit smoking. It's not because of public service announcements. It's because our kids told us,
right,
I really don't want you to die. Can you please stop smoking? You know, and when your kid asks you something on that level, it means something.
Yeah.
You know, and so I need kids to have that conversation with their parents and say, you know what? We should change our way. We shouldn't eat beef. We shouldn't fly planes as much as we do. We shouldn't buy a big SUV when actually we just need a sedan, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely, Hank. I appreciate it. No, it's an admirable mission, and thank you for undertaking the endeavor. I have just a couple questions left, Hank, if that's okay. So looking back at your accomplishments and experiences, is there a particular personal quality and attribute that you think has been instrumental in your success? My guess is it'd be persistence.
People ask me if I have hope, and I always tell, no, I don't have hope. I have determination. So determination. I mean, you just have to, this is going to happen. You have to manifest this. So
yeah,
I don't need people to have hope. I just need people to have confidence. Anyway, things get done if people have the confidence that they can do it. If they don't have confidence, then it's like, you know, they don't have the energy to get it done. But this is absolutely something. First of all, we can do. We have all the technology.
Mm-hmm.
This is 2023 now. There ain't nothing we can't do. There's absolutely nothing that we can't do. If we wanted to send somebody to live on the moon, we could send somebody to live on the moon. There's nothing we can't do. We can fix this, and it's going to be a lot cheaper for us to fix climate change than to move all of our major cities another 30 feet above sea level.
Right.
Sea level has been higher by 90 feet once upon a time. Yeah, just do the calculation. How much is it going to cost us to move all those people? And then there's going to be places in the world where, you know, like countries are going to disappear, like Bangladesh. How many hundreds of millions of people are you going to move to higher ground? You think there's no people living on that higher ground? No, this is going to cause massive, massive conflict on biblical proportion. So what we need to do is we just need to bite the bullet and fix this. And a lot of money is going to be made in the transition because it's a transition that absolutely has to be made. And by the way, we spend $7 trillion a year subsidizing fossil fuel. Hey, if we spend $7 trillion fixing climate, we would be there by now.
Yeah, understood. And it's a depressing thought, but it's nonetheless
a true one. It's a depressing thought, but it just means that we have to roll up our sleeves and get to work on this. It's not an impossible thing. In Hawaii now, everybody believes that we're going to get there. Everybody believes it. We went from everybody like, I don't know how we can or blah, blah, blah. No, everybody now thinks they're going to get there. That's what we need in the rest of the world. The whole world needs to think that way. That, yes, absolutely, we're going to get there. There's no question in my mind. It was funny, you know, you ask an expert, you're going to find out that they don't get it. I'm on a panel, and this guy, I say, we're going to go 100% renewable energy by 2045. And the guy next to me says, I'm a professor at the university. This is what I study. There is no way we can go 100% by 2045. And I took the mic and I said, well, I'm not as smart as this guy, so I'm going to do it anyway. And we are killing it. So, I mean, it's like, if you ask an expert, he will look at the past.
Right.
Look at the past. You absolutely have no confidence that it's going to fix the future because the past sucks. And basically, people don't understand how big a change can happen. You know, like the big change of, for example, electricity or computers or social media or, I mean, these things are huge changes and they happen all the time. And if you don't believe that those same kind of things happen, then you're not noticing.
Right.
But they do happen. And the carbon-based fuel is going to be one of those things that people read about in the history books. Oh, and then there was the Industrial Revolution and internal combustion became popular. And then we had this big climate problem. And then they solved the climate problem by switching to renewable energy. And blah, blah, blah. It's just going to be a footnote. You know, look, there's cities in the world that are completely clean. Reykjavik, I went to visit there. It used to be covered with a cloud of coal dust. They use it for heat and hot water. Now, heat and hot water comes from geothermal. It's just right there. You just have to drill down into the ground and get it. And there's so many sources like that. Wind and solar, hydro. I mean, they're all there. They're ready for us to use them instead of fossil fuel. It just makes no sense.
Yeah, understood. I agree with you. That's wonderful. It's a great mission. I'd love to know, Hank, if you could offer one piece of advice to your younger self, what would it be?
You know, I never did do a lot of studying. I might have said, you know, learn to take notes or something. I have so many bad habits from school, like I knew everything and why do I have to take notes and all that. I would say, what would I say? You know, stay on the path, you know, like young people, they're worried about being outside the box. And so I say to them, if you're outside the box, stay outside the box. Do not get in that box. You know, inside the box is a job that you probably don't like. And you can live your whole life doing something that you don't like, or you can stay outside the box and do something that you really like and money will happen. You know, that's just do something, especially if it's something that nobody else is doing. Oh, are you kidding me? That's the place you want to go. Do something that no one else dares to do. So I was a little bit naive when I was young about what I was doing, but that naivety, in fact, helped me. Because if I'd gone to school properly, I would have learned what I couldn't do or what I shouldn't do or what is never going to happen. And I think that's kind of why I dropped out of school when I did.
How important is luck in success, Hank?
Luck, you know, so luck, you could strike out like 100 times. That would be very unlucky, but it's unlikely that you're going to be unlucky that many times. Mm. So basically what you need to do is you need to try and fail and try and fail and try and fail. And then all of a sudden you could say, hey, the fourth time or the fifth time you got lucky. And I got lucky the first time, which is very rare. But if you don't try, you're never going to get lucky. So luck is, yes, you could say it's all lucky. I was lucky that I was the first one to make a role-playing game in Japan. That was lucky. But the other way is like, yeah, I did it and it worked. So yeah, there's some skill in that, you know?
Right. And my answer will no doubt have far less firepower than yours, is that I think it's important to try and live at the intersection of fortune and preparation, because luck by all means plays a role, but you have to prepare in a sense of knowing what you're doing and having a goal. I mean, it wasn't luck, in my view, it wasn't luck necessarily that got you over to the Soviet Union or through the door of V-Log that first time.
School of Hard Knocks. So I like to compare all of that to surfing. So the big wave comes, and if you've been surfing smaller waves and you've fallen off your board 100 times or 1,000 times and learned how to surf, then when the big wave comes, you know how to surf. Mm. But if you go out there and when the big wave comes and you've never surfed before, you're going to die. So fall off your board, you know, like learn on the smaller waves and then work your way up. And then finally, you will be able to surf Waimea or Jaws or whatever it is. The big thing, you know, for me, the big wave was role-playing games in Japan. And the second big wave was mobile phone games in the U.S., that's where I made all of my money, is watching that wave coming. I knew it was coming because it already happened in Japan. And I saw this wave coming at me. And, you know, the biggest advance I got of trying to license Tetris for somebody was like $25,000. And you got to be kidding me. You guys have no idea how big this business is going to be. So I decided I'm going to start it myself. And so, yeah, I started that business. And the company that that offered me $25,000 3 years later bought my company with all of the money they made by going public.
Oh, that's wonderful, Hank. Let me see. I'd love to know, obviously, you've been interviewed, you know, many, many times over the years. Just out of pure curiosity, is there a question that hasn't been asked of you that you wish someone would ask?
Oh, no, not really. Everybody asks me all kinds of questions. This is probably 80-something's interview on this particular trip since the movie.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, and I've been asked this particular question before also, but I don't think there's a question that I haven't been asked at this point.
I think that's fair.
You know, what do you do for exercise? That there is something different. And the answer to that is I play table tennis.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. So I haven't told anybody in the 80 interviews that I play table tennis yet. So there you go.
Perfect. Hey, that's, I got the exclusive. I'll take it.
And eye coordination, speed, spin, control, move your body. I totally break a sweat. This is not ping pong. It's not like standing there and reaching for the ball. You're moving as if you're playing tennis or squash. You're moving and then you're taking proper. It's hard work, put it this way.
Brilliant. Hank Rogers, how can people find out about you, sir?
HankRogers.com would be a good start. You could follow me on social media. I'm fairly sure I've got Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, and follow me if you can.
Brilliant. Perfect. Hank, this was such a pleasure. I really appreciate you taking the time for me. Thank you.
All right. It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.